Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Good morning, everyone. We will call the Healthcare Reform Review Committee to order. And the first order of business is to take the roll. Jennifer?
Thank you. Representatives Kaiser?
Here.
Becker? Fair?
Here.
Flansbog? Glassheim? Johnson? Here. LaFleur?
Here.
Wilson?
Here.
Mitzgag?
Here.
And Rohr. Senators Campbell? Mathern?
Aye.
And O'Connell?
We do have a quorum. I want to welcome everyone. It's great to see some new folks. Representative Casper. Oh. Yeah. Representative Casper.
My apologies. We can't update this. I will get you on.
That means you cannot be paid for today's work, Representative. All right. The next item on our agenda is to review the supplementary rules of operation procedure of the North Dakota Legislative Management. Jennifer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members and members of the public that are here, we've got this document, which for those of you that have been here before, this is an old friend. I've gone through it, and I just want to highlight a couple items here that might be of interest. These are the rules we need to play by during the interim. They're very similar to session. There's some differences. One thing to point out is that if the chairman should call this meeting and allow teleconference or some interactive video, some other type of attendance, he needs to post that ahead of time, and he needs to offer that to everyone in the committee. The reason I point that out is if we put our notice out as a traditional meeting and one member contacts us and says, you know, I'm going to be unable to attend in person, can I phone in and participate that way? Can't offer that to just one person. We need, if the chairman decides to offer that to one person, we need to offer it to everybody. So keep that in mind if you're ever going to make a request like that, that you need to make that early enough to give the chairman an opportunity to respond. Just like in session, every member who is present must vote on every question for every recorded roll call vote. So when you're here, make sure you're here. One of the things that as professional staff we're moving towards, and this is more for individuals who present to the committee, we're trying to ask ahead of time if you've got a written document, if you have it electronically. If you can get that to me ahead of time, it allows our support staff to then put a hyperlink on the agenda, either the day before or the morning of the meeting. Another thing it does, even if you can't get it to us ahead of time, is it allows us to put a clean copy then on our links for our minutes so that you've got a nice version out there. So if you can help me do that, I'd appreciate it. As we've got members of the legislative management, the nature of that role is that they can attend any one of these interim committee meetings, and then at the discretion of the chairman of that committee, they can come up and participate and sit at the table. So we may have members that come and join us time to time. We've got a study charge. We've got two of them right now. We need to stick to that. If we want to, if the committee as a whole or the chairman wants to expand it, we need to get authorization from the chairman of the legislative management. You've probably heard of a two reading rule for the bill drafts as we, maybe this time next year, as we're looking at our bill drafts. We all say, oh, we can't act on that if we've only had one reading. Just for clarification, what we say is if it's a bill draft prepared by somebody other than the legislative council office, then there needs to be two readings. Some of the rationale for that includes if it's drafted by somebody other than legislative management, it may not have been talked about at a previous meeting. So there wasn't really a public notice through the minutes or through the meeting itself to cue people in to come in and be aware of that opportunity to speak about that matter. If we've drafted as legislative management, in theory, we've talked about it before. So regardless, we're going to come to some resolution, some decision as a whole by this body, and we're going to pass that on to the legislative management. The legislative management then will determine whether they want to make some directive to the governor to contact the federal government. And we don't need to get into the details of that, but the reason I'm saying that is this committee is never going to make a statement or publish something or make, you know, some decision without running it by the legislative management first. And what we're doing here is reflective of that. We're going to make some ultimate decision, and we're going to take it right on to legislative management, and they can do with it what they want. So keep that in mind. We are underneath the legislative management. We always need to behave as such. On that note, careful about not appointing subcommittees without thinking about it carefully. If you've got a subcommittee that's appointed, one thing that needs to happen is the chairman of the legislative management needs to approve that action first, and then we need to treat it just like we would the committee as a whole. We need to notice meetings, we need to have staff there to record it, we need to do minutes, we need to, that's, we'll go back to. Don't do that without approval of the legislative management chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I generally will not provide the opportunity for a call-in attendance. As Jennifer explained, if we allow one person to call in, everyone can call in. And in the past, as one of the advantages of experience, you may have no one sitting in this room but the chairman or one other person that lives in Bismarck. And that's really not what our folks expect, social at least. Although with this committee, as I look at the audience, we have all the expertise we really do need on the issues that we are going to be addressing. Jennifer is going to go into today's meeting is really very limited. It's limited primarily to the essential health benefits. I want to thank all of you for your quick response and your willingness to perhaps in some cases to be very flexible and be here today. One of the issues that you occasionally run into with the Affordable Care Act is timelines. The timeline for the state of North Dakota to make a decision relative to the Essential Health Benefit Plan has actually passed. It was July 1. The insurance department has made a formal request, and they'll explain that in some detail, for an opportunity for the state of North Dakota to come in a little bit later with any, if we want to make any changes. However, it was July 30th that we had sort of suggested to the federal government that we would be coming in with a recommendation. Thus, we have a meeting before July 30th with some time. We're gonna go through all the steps that are required relative to this process this morning. I'm not going to take time to do that at this point. But as Jennifer indicated, we have in House Bill 1378 set up a process by which this committee has some role to play in consideration of essential health benefits for the state of North Dakota. And as Jennifer indicated, today is the meeting. I'm sorry to thrust it on you as quickly as we are, but we're going to do the best we can with the presentations we have for you today to define the process, the issues, what we can, what we can't do, what our limitations are. And then we're going to have committee discussion and make a decision. And the decision may be to do nothing. The decision may be to take a specific action. And that would be a recommendation to legislative management. And then the process would continue. In subsequent meetings, we're going to spend a great deal of time on 1332. That's the federal guideline rule, whatever it is. 2017, as you've often heard, 2017 is a critical period where states will have an opportunity, and we're going to work very hard to understand what that opportunity really is, but states will have an opportunity to make requests to adjust, adapt their plan, to take over their plan, to do a lot of things. So we've got a lot of education that will be occurring early during our interim, but we will be working, much like we did two interims ago when we looked at a state-based exchange, we will be meeting regularly and trying to reach some kind of decision relative to what we might be doing in regards to 1332. But that's what we'll be doing, and with that, the next item on our agenda, by the way, Senator Mathern said, are we really going to be done by noon today? And the answer to that question is yes, we are really going to be done by noon today, I hope. Again, we'll focus just on the essential health benefits portion at this time. Now we have a presentation by Jennifer on the selection of essential health benefits under House Bill 1378. Jennifer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the note of we're going to be a half day, I've asked a question upstairs about your vouchers and how the appropriate way to fill them out. If we really are done by noon, what they've told me is claim a half day per diem for today. If you've got travel, you can always add another half day to that. So we're going to max out at one day. If you have concerns about that, after the meeting, come visit with me and we can talk it through. But otherwise, that's the instruction I've received from upstairs. Okay, so enough of housekeeping. So now you've got your background memo. This committee has two study charges. We're just dealing with this one today. We're just dealing with the essential health benefits, so you've only got one background memorandum today. What I want to bring to your attention first is we've attached the bill that was the impetus for this study, and that's House Bill 1378. You'll notice from the number on that, 1378, is it came along a little bit later in the session. It was reactive to information provided by the federal government that this issue of selecting essential health benefits was coming, put the Legislative Assembly in a position to recognize it was happening and try to set a procedure to how to address it before we really knew what the rules were going to be. So you've got this directive. What it says is the legislative management needs to assign this study to an interim committee. That's us. And what we need to do is we need to evaluate the proposed rule on selection of essential health benefits for the 2017 ACA plan years forward. Okay, so what we're talking about doing here would become available for those open enrollment period that starts, in October or November of 2016. So you're selecting that January 1 effective date, January 1, 2017. That's, if you think out the timeline on that, that's what we're talking about is 2017. We already have essential health benefits established right now. We did that back in the 11-12 interim, all right? So for those of you who weren't around for that 11-12 interim, as part of what our discussion will be, and then I know that Rebecca Turnus from the Insurance Department will also give you some background on it. So between the two of us, we ought to be able to fill it all in. So looking at the study charge and what it's telling us to do is it's telling this committee, look at the federal directive, find out what they've directed the states to do. I can tell you what they've told us to do is look at 10 benchmark plans, insurance plans, and then select from one of those. We don't get to a la carte. We don't get to choose the benefits from each of the variety. You don't look at those 10 plans and go, boy, between all of those plans, these are the ones I want to take. What the feds have told us is select that one. If you want to add a benefit onto it, I think the right protocol for that would be to introduce legislation, go through a health insurance mandate. Okay, we know how to do that. So if this committee decides there's a benchmark plan that they want to recommend to the legislative management, and there's also some things that they think should be added to it, then we can do that in the course of recommending legislation just like we do in a typical committee, okay? So that's what the feds have told us to do, is they've identified 10 types of plans. Our insurance commissioner's office has figured out what those plans are through the parameters, the largest small group health plan, the top three largest small group health plans. They've identified them, and they've been grabbing information on it, so they'll come up and report on that and tell you, here's what those 10 plans are and here's what we think are in them. So that's what we have to choose from, are those 10 plans. If the states don't choose one of those plans, then the federal government has identified a default. It said if you don't act or you determine that you're not going to act, you've made an affirmative decision not to choose a plan, then here's what your default is. And we can talk about what that is. So that's kind of where we're placed right now. When 1378 was drafted, there was a lot up in the air. The rules weren't final. We weren't quite sure. But what we did know is that we were directing a subgroup of the Legislative Assembly to look into this. And we wanted to make sure that the Legislative Assembly as a whole had given this committee some parameters. So we had some directives saying, make sure you don't go too far. Make sure that we have a sense of security about what you're going to recommend to the legislative management. And the way we did that is we said, regardless of what comes out of this process, when the legislative management is done looking at our recommendations, if they make a recommendation, it can't offer benefits that are greater than the benefits packages we looked at 2 years ago, you know, 4 years ago, in that 11-12, the very first time we did it. We can't be broader than that, or we can't be broader than the 10 benchmarks that we're given today, or we can't be broader than, in this third one, than the current benefit package, essential health benefit package we have today. Now, as a matter of background, that makes our universe a little bit bigger. As a matter of practice, our universe is pretty small because the feds have said you get to choose from these 10 benchmark plans. So keep in mind that as this was written, it was the Legislative Assembly's attempt to say, we want to give this committee parameters and make sure they don't do anything that would surprise the legislative body as a whole. In practice, this committee is faced with 10 benchmark plans. Do you like any of them? You know, choose one. Okay? So that's what they're telling us to do. After this committee finishes up its work, it'll make a recommendation to the legislative management. Legislative management then has the discretion whether they want to make a recommendation to the governor to contact the federal government. The legislative management could make the decision that they choose not to give a directive to the governor. And then what would likely happen from that is that we would go to the default. Or the recommendation to the federal government or to the governor and to the federal government could be, our recommendation is that we default. So the pragmatic, you know, as a matter of process, that's what's going to happen. The reason I talk about processes, the chairman talks about what our timeline is. You know, we were supposed to have this done by June 1st. Well, we didn't. Well, then there was, you know, kind of an accepted understanding from the federal government to a lot of the states that we're going to give you another month. Well, we didn't get that done either. So now maybe by the end of July, time is of the essence here. Once these federal rules are finalized, we may be too late to give our input. So that's what the chairman is saying is, we need to get going on it. You make your decision, that's not the final decision. It then needs to go to the legislative management. They need to meet. They need to have notice to meet and look at our, review our recommendation. It's still not done. Then it needs to go to the governor, and he needs to make that recommendation. So just because we've finished our work doesn't mean that we've met some federal expected deadline. We have to be aware that there's things that happen after we make our recommendation. In addition to the selection of essential health benefits, which we need to, you know, the idea is act on this quickly. If you'll notice down here in subsection 3 on this bill, it says, if during the course of the committee's study, all or a portion of the Federal Affordable Care Act is repealed, then we need to look at how that may affect our decision on essential health benefit and if we want to make any recommended changes on that. So it does keep kind of our toe in the water to make sure that we're aware of what's happening under the ACA. Now in reality, we've got our second study that we're not dealing with today, but that says follow our healthcare delivery system, and we can fit it in there. But just keep you aware that this bill does direct us to stay apprised of how the Affordable Care Act might affect essential health benefits, and if some part of that Affordable Care Act changes, goes away, we've got this a directive to address that. So now that we've spent a lot of time going over the bill itself, I'll quickly go through the background memorandum in itself. We talk about those 10 benchmark plans. We're essentially doing what we did last time, back in 2011-2012. The feds have said, here are the 10 benchmark plans, and that's 1, 2, 3, 4, the largest plan by enrollment of any of the three largest small group insurance products, any of the three largest state employee health benefit plans, any of the three largest federal employee health benefit plans, and the largest commercial non-Medicaid HMO. So those are the parameters they've given us. The insurance department has then worked with the insurers and gotten all the data and has identified what those 10 plans are. Regardless of what the benefits are in those plans, the federal government has laid over the top of that 10 essential health benefits that they say, regardless of what your plans do, you need to make sure that by the time they're offered on the exchange, they offer these 10 things. And then we've got a list of 10 here, the ambulatory emergency hospitalization, maternity and newborn, mental and substance abuse, prescription drugs, rehabilitative and habilitative services, laboratory services, preventative and wellness, and pediatric services. So regardless of what plans you look at in our benchmark, if it's a grandfathered plan, it may not have some of these items on it. Ultimately, by the time it's offered on the exchange, it's going to have to include those 10 items. Also, keep in mind that we've got some federal laws that have developed over the last couple years that it's possible our benchmark plans don't include. I'm specifically thinking of substance abuse and mental health. That's evolved a little bit, and some rules have been finalized. So there are some nuances to this. I think Rebecca will go into that a little bit as she makes her presentation. So we've got these benchmark plans. Just like last time, this committee received a lot of information. Last time we did this, the insurance commissioner's office had hired a INS consultant. So they came in and did meetings and gathered data and then presented to this committee. This committee then kind of did an unofficial straw poll about where they thought this should go. Now I say unofficial because remember these supplemental rules before? They say pretty clearly that this committee can't make some final directive without running up the flagpole with legislative management. So last time we did this, this committee didn't have any standing to say, this is our determination, this is what we think you should do. So we took an unofficial sense of where's the discussion going. Okay, and after receiving that information, the insurance commissioner then went and made a recommendation to the federal to the feds. So that's how we did it last time. This time we're trying to avoid that kind of elusive process, and we've got a set process here. As far as study approach, you can look at that. I think we've kind of gone through it. I think primarily is time is of the essence. The insurance commissioner's office has done quite a bit of work for us ahead of time in pulling together this information. They've worked closely with the insurers, with the carriers, to gather this information. We've also, as you look at our agenda, asked the carriers to come on and be available for a panel discussion. So they've been active in putting together the insurance commissioner's data. So I think we should be pretty tight. As far as our process or what our study charge is, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Any questions from committee members?
I encourage you, committee members, to ask questions as we're going through this, because we do need to understand exactly what we're doing, where we're at, what are the limitations that we have. Senator Nevin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could get a further explanation from Jennifer. No decision results into a default position. And what is the default?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mattern, I think what the default is, so I read it correctly here. I think it's going to be the largest small group. Is that right? Rebecca's nodding. It's the largest small group would be our default. And I believe that was the same default we had last time we were faced with making this decision. Which I need to clarify, it's not necessarily the same plan, it's the same benchmark parameter where they said whatever plan that is, that will be your default. I think they've said the same thing this time. Whatever plan that is, that will be your default.
And that will be explained today.
Mm-hmm.
By the
right.
insurers or the insurance agency, the insurance commissioner's office, in terms of what's the name of that plan?
Absolutely. All 10 of those plans will be identified. And one thing to add to that, for those of you who weren't following this last time we did it, I can send out an email to committee members that's got a link to the final report from that committee's activities, and I can also send out a link to the consultant's report. The insurance commissioner's office contracted with INS consultants, and they put together a 79-page report. I think Rebecca will probably tell you that they've used that as their model, so that as we look at what they present this time, if you want to look back and compare it, it will be similar, so it'll be helpful to look at those two. But I can send you a link to that because it is accessible.
Thank you very much for the question, because committee members, regardless of your opinion about the Affordable Care Act, this is one of those situations, again, where non-action doesn't stop it. It just results in a different outcome. And the question the committee has to decide is that the outcome you want? And if it isn't, then you do have to make a decision to make a change or to keep it as it is. So that's the pressure that we have before us. So thank you very much for the question, because that's really at the heart. And it's also reinforces the problem we have with timing and the reason we have this meeting today. Any other questions for Jennifer? I encourage committee members on this committee at any time, if a question arises relative to anything Jennifer covered in this overview, please ask the question and come back. I promise if you have a question, probably other people do too. So this hopefully will be a very interactive and active committee. So I encourage that participation. All right, now for the star of our show. Once again, for the new committee members, this committee operates a little bit differently in that we do bring all of the stakeholders are invited to come in and participate in a planning session. And we kind of go over the general issues that we need to cover and get excellent recommendations from the carriers, from the insurance department, from other interested parties relative to information that should be covered, things we should do or not do. And this really is the insurance department's pretty much their show today. So, Rebecca, good luck.
I appreciate that. Good morning, Chairman Kaiser, members of the committee. I'm Rebecca Turnus, Deputy Insurance Commissioner at the North Dakota Insurance Department. I wish I could say what Jen said. I think I'll go into a little more detail, but she did a great job of reviewing the bill and also the process for 2017. And as she said, we did some comparisons. You've got a lot of paper in front of you, and we'll try to get through it. We try not to make our testimony this long.
And again, we start with the statements about 2017. What date in 2017? Is it January 1st, July 1st? When is it?
Plans renewing after January 1st, 2017, which the majority are renewing on January 1st, 2017 that are impacted by this.
But that means that the insurance department has to approve those plans.
Correct.
And review them. And when do you need them submitted for your review to be approved on January 1st?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, each year now the federal government determines when the insurance department has to approve rates and forms for plans for the next policy year. This year we had to have them done in July. The end of July is our deadline. The companies obviously have to have them to us sooner, and we can tell the companies when we need them. We have by statute 60 days to approve a plan. We can extend that another 15 days for a total of 75 days to approve rates and forms. So we usually step it out from whenever we have to give them to the federal government and approve.
But I guess the point I'm making is January 1 is their deadline, but functionally the deadline is earlier than that.
Mr. Chairman, that's a very good point, yes. And carriers need time to build their models, to rate them, to discuss what they want to offer. You know, there are changes coming. There's Assurant was never on the marketplace, but they were in the market. They no longer are selling in the state of North Dakota and many other states. It's not just us. But so yeah, there's a lot of changes and things that carriers need to be able to consider. It's a very good point. Well, I was asked to present on the history. I think Jennifer has covered a lot of this, so if I go too fast, just stop me. The Affordable Care Act did include essential health benefits, or what we commonly call EHB, and for non-grandfathered individual and small group plans. This does not impact large group plans. The number for large group is going to be changing soon, and I don't think we need to get into that today, but this does not include large group plans. And so that's what we're talking about, individual and small group non-grandfathered plans. In 2012, we were given the opportunity to recommend a plan to service the EHB benchmark plan and then recommend that plan to the U.S. Health and Human Services. And the secretary at the time then formally selected the plan through a rule. So it is a rulemaking process for the Health and Human Services Group. For those of you who were involved in that or discussed that with us at the time, you'll know that it was, and Mr. Chairman alluded to this, the Insurance Department and Commissioner Hamm felt very strongly that that was a legislative function. All of the state mandates, which are on the last page of this chart that was handed out, have always been decided by the legislature, not by an agency. And we had written letters to the Secretary of HHS asking for a delay to allow the 2013 legislature to make that decision as an entire body, and we were not given the ability to do that from the federal government. So we stepped through the process that has been described here. That at the time we made that decision in 2012, or made a recommendation in 2012, we were told that was for the plan years 2014 and 2015, and we now really have not been given to us in writing, but we're fairly certain now that also means the plan years 2016, which is what the carriers are working on and have sent us now that we are reviewing. So, as Jennifer said, she talked about on page 2 of my testimony, the choices. There's the definition of the choices, small group plans, the state employee plans, the federal employee plans, and the largest HMO. And once it was chosen, it applied to those non-grandfathered small group and individual plans. And just a reminder, non-grandfathered plans are any plans sold after March 23rd, 2010, which was the date the president signed the PPAC or ACA. And again, in the 10 categories that must be in the EHB plans, what that means is there has to be benefits in those areas in the plans. There was not a lot of definition given as to the level of benefits. And there could be no annual or lifetime limits now on dollar limits on those benefits. And there's lots of nuances to the way these 10 benefits are in every plan and the way they're covered and to what level they're covered. So I just wanted to remind you of that. And again, we testified numerous times during the 11-12 interim to this same committee. We had very good discussion. And outside of the committee, we also received comments on a variety of other decisions that were the state was able to make and different things we were able to do during that time. And on our website at the Insurance Department, you can see everything, every comment that we got. We had a very robust process going on both behind the scenes. We hired a consultant, as Jen said. And then, of course, the committee heard numerous times from the insurance companies and other interested parties here for formal testimony. Jen mentioned I'm on the top of page 3, the straw vote that was taken in the last committee meeting. And I think the discussion really ended up with, do we choose a richer plan, or do we choose a plan that maybe isn't as rich? A reminder that all the plans that we were looking at were very good insurance plans. You know, we're lucky in North Dakota. Most of what was sold here had a very good set of benefits. We were in a fairly good position in our choices. So it wasn't like we had a bad plan and a good plan. We just had some plans that maybe offered a little bit richer benefits. And the discussion was, richer benefits cost people premiums, because obviously if claims are going out on benefits and there's more claims to be paid, companies will have to charge higher premiums. And in the end, the majority of the committee, I was sitting here trying to remember, was it a 10-2 or something like that vote, tended to opt towards the more basic plan that didn't have some of the richer benefits. We also did discuss the ability to add mandated benefit coverage in future sessions. And what the rules say on that is, at any time this body can decide that we want to cover a new benefit in the state of North Dakota. And what you would be doing is adding to that list on the back page of that chart, and you'd be saying all carriers that offer plans in the state of North Dakota must include XYZ benefit. But again, then the state has to bear the cost that's over and above any essential health benefits required. So we talked about that during that interim as well. And since that time, no benefits have been added that are mandated benefits. We've changed some things with telemedicine. That's not considered a benefit mandate. That's considered a delivery method, so it's different. So there's been some things changed with regards to what's required for plans, but we really haven't added any benefits. So in the end, we did choose the state's HMO plan, the largest by enrollment HMO plan. That was the Sanford Health Plan. And then we had to supplement it because no plan at the time offered all of the 10 EHB benefits. So it was supplemented, and specifically no plan offered pediatric dental and vision. And so we chose the state's CHIP plan benefits for those areas as the supplemental benefits that had to go with the EHB plans. And so the carriers now have built their plans, that the new plans around that that were offered January 1st, 2014, and that's where we're at today. So for 17, Jen went through the choice, and again, it is the same. We have the four categories of types of plans that we can choose from, and they are limited by the enrollment, by their numbers of enrollment. And the selections were due to HHS on June 1st. Many states asked for, and they were allowed, delays until July 1st. We asked for, can we get a later delay? And they said, no, I'm sorry, July 1st is the last date. So we have formally informed them that we have a legislative process going on. We've never received anything in writing that says that we're okay, but verbally we have been told that should we make a selection, even after any proposed rules are written, but before any final rules, we will likely be able to change our default status to a selection. So right now, formally, we are defaulted to the largest small group plan, the largest product in the small group plans. So for us, that is the Blue Cross Blue Shield Small Group Exchange Plan. Senator Mather, I know you had asked about that. The product has 3,222 people enrolled as of March 31st, 2014. That doesn't sound like a lot of people.
Rebecca, the question. Representative Casper.
Rebecca, you're not updating plans. Are you referencing now this chart?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Casper, yes. This. Mr. Chairman, Representative Kaiser, yes, you'd be looking at the first column. So under small group plans, BCBS.
Rebecca, just a clarification, because I think I know where Representative Casper. Is this the chart from 4 years ago?
Mr. Chairman, this chart is, yes, as similar as we could possibly make it from 4 years ago. With the, and I'm getting to that, but it has all of the 10 choices.
Right.
That we can make.
But in terms of covered services, and this will be interesting for the committee, all states face the same dilemma. They had to list their plans and make choices. But what did happen was, in North Dakota's case, we chose the least enriched plan. As Rebecca stated, they were all good plans. They all covered all 28 mandates or whatever number we had. By law, they had to cover them. New York, in contrast to North Dakota, chose a plan in the middle of their enriched array. But regardless of where the state went, all the other plans in the state pretty much moved right to that plan because of adverse selection. So can we choose from the plans going back 2 years, or do we have, or are we limited, and do we have to redo this chart showing that plan and what it really covers today versus what it covered 2 years ago?
Mr. Chairman, we are limited to choosing from plans that are on this list as of the first quarter, March 31st of 2014. We cannot go back to the 2012 plans.
Does everyone understand that? So are these benefits listed in that first column? Old benefits or new benefits?
Mr. Chairman, they're the benefits that existed in the plan March 31st, 2014.
Okay.
So I think what you're getting at is this, that most of these look very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about that, that there's really only one that has some dissimilar markings on this chart at this level of benefits. Now, the application of benefits, the specifics as to the limitations, we could have, you know, 90 hundreds of pages. And I think that's where the panel of insurance carriers are going to be very helpful to you if you have specific interest in very specifics about anything in here.
Right.
We model this after that INS chart. This is as much definition as we can get to for the EHB 10 categories according to any federal guidance that we've received.
Representative Casper.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Casper, the existing EHB benchmark plan is the Sanford HMO plan.
You said we just defaulted.
No, we did not default. We made a selection in 2012.
I thought you said we defaulted because of the
county. We are currently in default for the 2017 choice. So the current benchmark plan is the Sanford plan. And what the benchmark that all plans have to meet currently for years 14, 15, and now we know 16, was the Sanford 2012 HMO plan supplemented by everything required in the 10 benefit categories. All of these plans, except for the grandfathered NDPERS plan, meet the benchmark. Now, they could be slightly different in the application of specific benefits. They could be, they could have more benefits in some areas. They could not have less than what that Sanford plan had in it, supplemented by the 10 EHB categories.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Casper, I think where we're getting off track here is that particular plan that existed in 2012 isn't on this chart. That was a benchmark that everyone had to meet at least at a minimum.
We do not really on this chart have our
current benchmark. Mr. Chairman, Representative Casper, all of these meet the benchmark, but that particular plan is not on here. Mr. Chairman, Representative Castor, my answer would be the same. The 2012 Sanford plan was a benchmark, but it had to be added to. So there really is no particular one plan that exists that actually was sold here, because that plan didn't even meet everything that was required for EHB.
Yeah, Rebecca, and I understand the frustration.
Yes.
We've got the 10 plans here.
Yep.
Is the Sanford HMO plan, the furthest to the right, the current plan?
Mr. Chairman, the current benchmark? No, this is a different Sanford HMO plan.
Okay.
This is a large group Sanford HMO plan.
But we are currently, our EHB is based on, do we have that column?
Mr. Chairman, no, we don't.
That's what we're looking for.
Okay. I would say it's very similar to almost all of these plans on there, except for that grandfather plan, because that is the minimum that all of these plans had to meet. And it's hard to let go of the two, you and I have had these discussions, you kind of have to let go of the 2012 choices because they don't matter anymore. The federal government is not allowing us to go back in time and choose an old plan. We have to choose from the 2014 plans that were there on March 31st that meet those four criteria for enrollment.
So given that we initially selected the Sanford plan, which is no longer here, the committee's decision at this point has to be based on these plans as they are written on this sheet.
That's correct.
Representative Casper.
Right, Mr. Chairman. The problem is frustration that I'm experiencing. We cannot compare then based upon this chart where we're currently at and where our current benefits are compared to the new benefits we have to meet to see whether or not we're enhancing anything which could potentially increase our costs to the providers and to the insurers. So you can't compare current to what we're selecting against, which is frustrating to me. So if there was one call on the right that had the current plan that had the same X's and whatever, now I'd be very comfortable, but we can't compare.
Mr. Chair, if you'd let me just ask Lisa a quick question.
Is that central plan with my
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's about that, right?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman and Representative Casper, I just asked Lisa because I thought that was true. If you look at that second column, that Sanford Small Group Plan, that's almost exactly their 2012 plan plus the required supplemental benefits. All of these are, I mean, you know, I know what you're asking. You want to see that exact plan, but that exact plan is not one of our choices. So I understand what you're saying, but that's where we're at. Okay, so I am still on page four. Again, I want to remind you that if you choose to add mandated benefits, which would have to be done obviously in a legislative session, the state would again have to pay for any benefits that are over the EHB requirement. However, should we choose a benchmark from the 10 choices that currently has more benefits than the existing EHB, it would not be considered an additional mandate for the new benchmark and the state would not have to pay. And I know that's seems like I just said the opposite of what I meant to say. So one example is that on the PERS plan, if you go to the fourth page, and I know these don't have page numbers on them, but you'll see under prescription drugs, you'll see infertility drugs is the way it's listed here, and that none of the PERS plans cover infertility drugs. So let's just say that you would decide to go with the PERS plan as the benchmark plan. The state would not have to pay for those added benefits because you're choosing that as part of your benchmark. You're choosing a plan that exists that has that in it, and it becomes a new benchmark coverage. However, again, I will tell you that if you choose a plan with richer benefits, there could be a cost for everyone to pay for those benefits, whether they use them or not. So, and on the contrary, should the state choose an EHB with different or fewer benefits, the insurance companies could scale back the benefits, again, as long as the EHB 10 categories and all the other requirements are met. That may also change the cost of premiums if you would scale back, if there would be something that would be sufficient enough or material enough that it would make an actuarial difference in a premium. Any questions on that? I think I just went in a circle, so I want to make sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Rebecca. For the employee health plans, you have three of them here. Do we have a choice of all three of those? I mean, there isn't some common denominator of those three that we could choose. I mean, it's literally distinct plans within North Dakota PERS.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Mathern, you just asked the question of my handwritten note, which says there's no menu. You don't get to pick and choose from multiple plans. You have to pick one of those plans.
Even though they're all three within North Dakota PERS?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mathern, that's correct.
I was hoping maybe the umbrella would permit. So, okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mathern, I appreciate your sentiment because, yeah, it would be much nicer to do something different than this. But okay, so on the plan comparison chart that you have before you, you can see that the 10 choices. So each one of these represents those 10 choices out of those four categories. And this is modeled, again, on the previous chart that you had. All of the carriers are represented on here. You see Blue Cross Blue Shield, Sanford, and Medica. All of the actively selling carriers, I should say, in the state. And we have it marked where there's an X to indicate coverage and an NC to indicate no coverage. You'll note there's only one grandfathered plan on the list, and that is the NDPERS plan. The other PERS plans are the non-grandfathered plan and the high deductible non-grandfathered plan for the PERS plans. A couple of important points to make again is that this is coverage that was as of March 31st, 2014. On March 31st, 2014, we didn't have all the mental health parity stuff worked out. So you might see some kind of strange things in there. That does not mean that those plans don't have that coverage today. And that some of the benefits marked as not covered in one category might be found as covered in another. For example, on the third page, so the page before the fertility page that we were looking at, under mental health and substance abuse disorder, Sanford column indicates no coverage for detoxification. That benefit is now covered in the current plan. So since these 14 plans, now we have 15 plans. And they've also prepared 16 plans. So again, we're looking at a moment in time that the federal government said, you have to look at the plans as they were then. Which makes us that much more complicated, I realize. So I just two caveats. And if you have specific questions about those benefits, I really would prefer the carriers get into the details of the benefits. But
Mr. Chairman.
The Senator Madden.
Thank you. Rebecca, in light of that comment, are you saying then that a choice of the Sanford plan, second column, would actually roll back benefits that are presently available under that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Madden, I don't believe that's in the benchmark today because we're talking about the Sanford plan. But it could roll back benefits for those people who have 15 plans with Sanford today.
Okay.
Doesn't roll back the benchmark, but it could roll back benefits for in actuality and reality.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Okay, and then on the sixth page under preventive services, just another example I wanted to provide, and we're in category 9 now, which is preventive and wellness services and chronic disease management. You'll see under the grandfather's PERS plan several preventive services that are listed as not covered. Grandfather plans are not required to cover those services. However, you probably all know that a lot of these benefits may be found in another category, such as maternity coverage or new baby coverage, some of that kind of thing. So again, we listed them out as the EHB requirements, and grandfather plans don't have to have those, but that doesn't mean that that grandfather plan doesn't have it somewhere else. We were confused too when we did this, so we're happy to answer any questions. Again, on the last page is our list of state mandates, and what we did is we limited it to actual benefit mandates, not, you know, provider mandates and all those other kinds of things. When we talk about that higher number, we've got lots of other types of mandates that we consider mandates, but these are benefit mandates. So anywhere in the chart where you see a number next to a particular mandate or next to a particular coverage, you can correspond that to this last page, and that will say, hey, this is a mandate that had to be in there in 2012, that has to be in there today, nothing has changed. So then what we did, because this is actually, as detailed as this is kind of high level for coverage for folks, especially in specific areas. So what I asked the staff to do, and they did very well, was they dug into a few of these specific areas, and we focused on areas where we've gotten a lot of phone calls maybe since the EHB plans were chosen. We focused on areas where we kind of always get phone calls, and some areas where we've had discussions in the past with this committee and other committees. So in habilitative and rehabilitative services, again, a reminder for those of you who weren't involved, nobody talked about habilitative services in 2012, 2010, you know, before. That just was not in existence. Rehabilitative services, I get injured, I have some sort of an event, and I have to rehab. Those types of things were always included in policies. But habilitative, I've maybe never had that function or skill, and I want to grow in it, and I need additional assistance, medically necessary assistance. That was never something that was discussed in insurance policy. So that was new when EHB first hit. And it's caused a lot of learning curves, I think, both for us as regulators and for the companies and consumers, as to what does that mean, how is it defined. We did not define habilitative services for the state of North Dakota when we could have the first time, so the carriers were allowed to make a good faith effort to do that and to pretty much do them on parity with the rehabilitative services. Now they've more formally defined that for the carriers. I don't know that that's going to cause a lot of changes. There's some nuances that may change for the carriers. But several of the plans have combined habilitative and rehabilitative visit limits on speech, occupational therapy, and physical therapy, and they run between 30 and 90 days, which are allowed. These combined limits are allowed until 2017. After 2017, they're going to have to say, we have 60 days on this, 30 days on this, or whatever. But again, that's going to be something that you're going to want to talk about and think about. The PERS plans have limits on the length of days of speech treatment. Most of the others have maybe visit limits, but not length of days. It's a 90-day limit from the start of treatment, so that's something unique. Several plans exclude hearing aids or hearing aids for individuals over the age of 18 for rehabilitative services only. Again, this may depend on medical necessity, but you know that as I'm losing my hearing, and I'm not going to tell you my age, but as I'm losing my hearing, that if I chose to go get a hearing aid today because I just want to hear better, I'm going to have to pay for that myself. That would not be covered by my major medical policy, which is very common. Under chiropractic services, this is something that people tend to use a lot. Plan limits visits from 12 to 20, and the PERS grandfather plan has no limit on visits. So again, there's some variation there. Nutritional counseling is an area we've heard from in the past. Several plans have different visit limits for different types of conditions, and when we're talking about anorexia, bulimia, diabetes, hypertension, obesity, things like that. And some benefits are required coverage under preventive services according to medical necessity. So you can see how if you drill down into any one of these areas, there could be differences that we can't really account for on a chart like this. But if there are specific areas you want us to drill down in, or you want the carriers to drill down in, we can do that. We picked a few that we know have been kind of hot button issues, and we've looked at those. You know that under mental health and substance abuse, we dealt with the mental health parity issue before the 15 plans, and so those have all been taken care of for the age restriction and some of those things that existed that we took care of for the 15 plans. So that's why I didn't mention those, but so the only mandates that exist for mental health and substance abuse are still the ones that are listed on that back page. And so I want to, again, reinforce again, all the benefits must be medically necessary. You know, sometimes we get people calling saying they wouldn't prescribe me that drug, or that it wouldn't be covered, or they wouldn't let me do this treatment in Germany, and, you know, it's an elective type thing. Of course, again, insurance carriers can deny coverage for things that aren't medically necessary. If people disagree with that, they have appeal mechanisms and grievance mechanisms that they can go through. And medical providers and insurers will all apply treatments and benefits differently. And I really encourage you to question the insurers if you have a very specific area you want to drill into, because they know their benefits even better than we do. So with that, I'd be happy to take any other questions.
Questions for Rebecca from the committee. Representative Fair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rebecca, the biggest complaint that I hear, and I think most of us hear, is how the Affordable Care Act has resulted in increase in premiums, doubling, tripling, and more of premiums, making it less affordable for many people. As we look at our 10 choices, is there any choice that we make, and how can we look at choices in terms of what impact it may have on premiums, and to what extent we may or may not help people in terms of the premium increases?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fair, you're concerned about something that the Commissioner is very concerned about as well, since he has to approve all of these rates each time. And as you know, just the ACA itself brought in new taxes and fees that the carriers have to pay that get passed on as well in the form of premiums. Most of these plans are very similar, as you can tell already, and have the same benefits. There were no new categories of EHB added by the federal government, and you as a body did not add any mandates this last session or any previous sessions that would have added a cost like that. If, again, back to my example, if you would choose the PERS plan, just the differences that pops out the most to us are those infertility-fertility services and prescriptions. I think the carriers may be prepared today to speak to some of that. What would that cost per member per month? What would that be for a premium? That's something they determine with their actuaries, and then they bring to us and we ask them to justify during a rate increase. So any time that you choose a plan with richer benefits, there's that chance, depending on actuarially how many people are going to use that and put in claims. So I don't know that most of these choices are that vastly different from where we are today. So we are looking at, for cost increases, trend, what we call trend, which makes up the cost to increase to providers, the hospitals and the doctors, and when people overuse or they use more services. We've actually seen a fairly low trend the last couple years, lower than we thought it would stay, and it's stayed lower than where it's been. You know, I've been with the department 10 years, and we've never seen trends stay this low this long. So, but there's always going to be a medical inflationary increase in a rate request. Those costs have never gone down. And then if people use services more, we're going to see requests that are going to go up higher. And then again, if we add benefits, that's going to increase. If we would change our tax structure, or the federal government would change the tax structure, that would increase premiums as well.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I'm understanding the previous discussion we had with Representative Casper, which I may or may not have, if we basically want to continue what we've been doing, I think you're saying that we would select the Sanford Small Group Plan? Is that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fair, I think what's represented on this chart is as close to that 2012 plan. Yes.
Thank you. So if that selection was to continue what we're currently doing, is there any selection here that, in your opinion, would reduce premiums from where premiums are currently at?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fair, I would suggest there's not going to be much of a difference in any of these selections because, again, they all meet the minimums. And most, as Representative Kaiser alluded to, when we chose that 14 selection, most of the plans went to those minimums. And that is where we had the majority of our discussion with consumers, was because some benefits and some plans were reduced in some of the plans that had the richer benefits. So these plans are very similar. I don't know that you would be, that there's anything material in any of these that would reduce premiums. I think it is a good question for the carriers, though. They are the ones eventually who have to make the rate request to us and justify the differences, whether they're increases or decreases. Not something we see in health insurance, but we do in other lines of insurance sometimes. So.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So aside from a simple, because I think that's primarily what we're here to do today, but beyond that, is there anything in your opinion that we can do that will effectively lower premiums? Is there anything other states are doing? Is there any comments of anything that you can give us, whether it's part of our discussion today or necessarily or not, that would reduce premiums?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fair, I don't think this decision is going to do that. And because of the way the ACA is built, we don't have a lot of leeway. The companies don't have a lot of leeway. Now, they could design plans with more benefits. That really hasn't happened because obviously more benefits, their prices would be higher. But they have to, at a minimum, have these essential health benefits. So I don't see it happening. And we have seen cost increases, and part of those rate increases are costs related to the ACA, taxes, fees, benefits that didn't exist before in these plans through these essential health benefits. Now, I want to remind you that there's still a lot of people in this state on grandfathered plans that aren't going to have these benefits in their plan. And the carriers can bring in their numbers, but the majority of people, the PERS plan and all of you and me, have grandfathered plans. We have plans that don't have to meet these benefits. And won't as long as we're allowed to keep those plans and as long as the carriers offer to sell those plans. But there's no guarantees there either. Those plans also are increasing in cost. You know, it's that there's not to say that one increases and the other don't. So.
Senator Levin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rebecca, it seems to me that as I thought about Representative Ferris, comments about the citizens, it seems like I get more comments about surprises about the reductions in benefits. there was kind of a rollback to a lower common denominator in terms of benefit structure. And then the other thing I hear is frustration with the high deductibles, which I think are probably often related to the choices people make, you know, in terms of, you know, they didn't really understand that, yeah, this is a cheaper premium, but it really meant they have to pay for most of their care for cash. So those are the two things I hear. But I'm wondering about, do we have any evidence yet that the essential benefits plan or the essential benefits list partially was developed as a method to eventually control costs? You know, that certain things being covered would in fact be beneficial in the long term. Are there any indicators of that that you have yet, or are there choices here that maybe we should be looking at in that regard? You know, what plans really provide the greatest potential to keep people well or out of more expensive care?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mathern, I think the benefits are so similar until you get down into things like visit limits. You know, I mean, you got to get pretty deep into them, that there isn't a lot of difference in the benefits. Now, that said, you asked for evidence. And the 14 plans really just ended. You know, we're 6 months beyond the first year, and actuaries and statisticians would tell you that's not credible. 1 year is not credible anyway. Again, maybe the carriers have more to say about this. I don't know of anything that says requiring pediatric dental has had this positive impact. It probably has. And I think, you know, the CHIP people will probably talk to you about that, because that's been in the CHIP plan for a long time. You all put that in the CHIP plan a long time ago. But I don't know of anything that has said that that's done that yet. Again, maybe the carriers follow that a little bit closer than I do. But it's a good question.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions? Representative Lofar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to say thank you, Rebecca. Great testimony. I'm glad this isn't complex at all.
Sorry.
Just a couple of 101 type questions for you so I can understand this better. As we track this, and we all want the most benefits at the lowest cost, but are you seeing a trend where consumers are picking plans with higher deductibles, therefore increasing self-pay portions, which are out there, therefore increasing losses hospitals incur, therefore hospitals have to increase their prices? Isn't it kind of a merry-go-round? My question is that the world that we're facing right now that you see in the insurance department?
Mr. Chairman, Representative LaFleur, I don't really have all the numbers off the top of my head as far as the shifting. We're seeing some shifting to self-funded, which, again, not represented here. If you as an employer decide to go self-funded, you can design a benefit package that doesn't have to follow all of the ACA rules. So a little bit of that, maybe. Certainly, people are ending up in more high-deductible plans because of those out-of-pocket maximums that the federal plans can have in it, and maybe they are doing so unwittingly, or they just haven't paid attention or thought through that maybe I need to have that money in the bank just in case I have to spend it, because the premiums are lower. And as premiums continue to rise, people will tend to look for bargains, and those bargains they may not realize come at an additional cost down the road. So I think that has happened just because the market has changed, not necessarily because people have asked for it or companies have necessarily even wanted to do it. But they have to remain competitive too. They have to offer products that are going to go up against their competition. So there's definitely been a a very large change in health insurance in our state and the plans that are offered going forward. A lot of plans are no longer here anymore. And the companies can tell you more about the specifics of why they made those decisions, but they can come to us and stop selling a plan. We can't prohibit them from doing that. That's our free market here, and for them as private sector businesses. So they could get rid of grandfathered plans. Then we'd have a heck of a lot of people shopping for plans. And again, maybe their alternatives are an affordability. Maybe they're going to have higher deductibles, and that again will leave people maybe not paying their bills to providers and requiring communities to support their providers more. So I think we're really early in this process, and watching that happen and seeing how that will happen is going to play out over the years. Again, the 14 plans really just ended 6 months ago. We're just collecting data now, and the carriers are collecting their data, which again makes it difficult for them when they were giving us the 15 plan rates last summer, and now they're trying to do the 16 plan rates based on very recent data. I know that wasn't probably the best answer to that question, but and maybe ask it again of the carriers, and it might be helpful.
Thank you.
Additional question. Committee members, we do have a panel of carriers that will be coming up. And to Representative Affairs' question, as we do get into minimal weeds on these plans, we have asked the carriers if they can give us any kind of actuarial projection as you consider a benefit in or out, so that you can look at what the impact overall would be. And please recognize that we asked them to start this process about 10 days ago or whenever we met, and they can't do what we've asked them to do. So it's going to be very limited, but we're going to ask them anyway. So we will have them up here to look at that. But Rebecca, we do have a lot of new committee members here that haven't had experience with, as some of our committee members have two sessions ago. Let's just walk through very quickly the first column and the second column, the Blue Cross Blue Shield and Sanford plan in your matrix. The Sanford plan comes, it is basically what the EHB plan today is, that all entries into the market. And again, these are for the non-grandfathered individual, small group. Most individual markets are not grandfathered, but and many of the small groups are moving away from grandfathered because they can't meet the guidelines to remain grandfathered. But let's just walk through those. And if you go down, the first significant change is in private duty nursing on page one. It's about 7 or 8 from the bottom. Currently, the current EHB covers private duty nursing, and again, this is where it gets complicated. It doesn't cover it completely. There will be limitations on private.
Mr. Chairman, remember, this may not have been the EHB. It was the plan as it existed March 31st, 2014.
Right, but that's what we're dealing with.
Yep.
I mean, so then if we go down to page 2, everything is comparable on those plans. When we get to page 3 on hospitalization category, the major benefit category, going to Blue Cross Blue Shield, if we default and go to Blue Cross Blue Shield, transportation of recipient is not covered.
Organ transplant, yes.
Yep. And for that, and as well as lodging, is not covered, and it kind of currently is covered. I mean, going to the next page, we have a shift the other way. We would pick up coverage on birthing centers, and currently it's not covered, the charges. We do get in, on the mental health side, we get into a lot of issues, and if you were engaged during the last session or during the interim before that, mental health has been a big issue, and there have been a lot of negotiations with carriers on these subjects. But you can see that group therapy would become covered. It's not covered under the current, that small group plan, Sanford plan. Detoxification would be covered, it's not covered under that plan, and rehabilitative therapies would not be covered, and it is currently covered. So those are shifts between those two plans. If you go to, again, rehabilitative, number eight, rehabilitative and habilitative services, Sanford does not, that plan, I shouldn't say Sanford, that plan does not cover speech therapy, whereas transitioning to the largest small group plan would cover that benefit, and that's it. Those are the differences between those. Now, and I'm not going to do it, but you can now do that same contrast between those two plans with the PERS plan, and you might pick the middle of the PERS plan because that's a very enriched plan, comparatively speaking, to those two other plans. And the question for this committee is, and again, it's, you know, how do you keep the premiums low, and or do you, are you transferring costs to the providers or transferring costs to the which they're finding a different way to pass on to somebody else, or are you transferring the costs to the policy owner? What's happening with those as a result of those different benefits? In the interim, after we no longer were covering fertility or infertility, there weren't a lot of people that called us, but I've never had more motivated people that called me than certain grandparents and parents who used the funding through infertility treatment to have a child. If you want to really talk to somebody who can get excited, talk to those grandparents who have grandchildren as a result of that treatment. They think it's the number one priority, although it's a very, very small segment of the population. And you can't offer that treatment. This is the perfect example of adverse selection. I can assure you that my wife and I will not be buying infertility treatment if it's an option. It is not going to happen. So,
but Mr. Chairman, you'd be paying for it.
I could be paying for it. But so that's our task today, members of the committee, is to look at these plans in as much detail as we can. And if we can't make a decision, that's all right. It just defaults and goes over.
Mr. Chairman, I did also try to ask the NAIC to survey all the states as to where they're at as of June 1st, July 1st. And unfortunately, they had only received 16 responses as of yesterday. 10 states of those 16 had defaulted, and one of those 10 had actually chosen to default. The others just didn't answer. So I can provide you with that if you're interested in which states, but I don't have them all. I'm sorry. They were only able to get 16 answers for me. So right now, it's looking like a lot of default states. So,
any other questions for Rebecca? Representative Fair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Rebecca, if we default, what do we go to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fair, that first column, the Blue Cross Blue Shield small group plan.
I have a further question.
Senator Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You noted the mental health benefits and substance abuse high on the agenda of the last legislative session and some of this interim committee work. I find that even though that has been somewhat clarified, there is still considerable disparity between payers in terms of their definition of somebody who's actually chemically dependent or mentally ill. Or has there been any clarification so that, you know, these two columns actually mean the same? You know, when there is a covered, you know, like, you know, there's one on here that says partial day hospitalization, they both cover. Well, is there a clear definition as to whether one is medically indicated or not, and it seems like there's so much judgment in these areas, and these payers actually pay or do not pay based on judgment, not based on this chart. So it can say there's coverage, but actually no one has hospitalization for that or partial care for it because of the judgment issue, or vice versa. Another insurer might pay for all kinds of days. Has that been clarified at all, do you think, by this last insurance approval of these policies? Have you done more in the detail to have more consistent decision-making between the companies?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Mathern, you just described that intricacy that I was mentioning. Even though a company has to have benefits in a particular area, that does not tell you exactly how that company applies those benefits, how the doctor caring for that patient actually takes the notes that says that it's medically necessary and files that claim on behalf of that person. Each person's different. Each doctor's going to do it differently. I'm sure the carriers would probably tell you some providers, you know, over-treat certain things, and some maybe under-treat certain things. So you're never going to get a very clear picture, and there's been no, you know, federal action or state action that has further defined that. I think every patient is so different in every circumstance, and then every provider and every standard of care that they go through when they provide their care. Certainly every facility has different types of care they can offer. I just don't think there's a way to do that, to say you have to do it this way in this order. And we have things like formularies under prescription drugs, maybe, and step therapies and things like that are followed more strictly, but especially in mental health and substance abuse. I just don't know how you do it. And I understand what you're saying, because you could probably see the same patient at two different providers and get coverage from two different companies two different ways. One would deny the claim, one might pay it. It's just the world we live in. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Representative Franz Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rebecca, but don't the policies that are being given out, don't they define or identify the level of coverage? I'm referring to what the senator said, because it seems like there's some concern about what's actually covered, but the people that are writing the policy certainly must be able to tell you what the coverage is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Franz Fogg, the policy is going to tell you that there's coverage for a particular benefit. It will not say every time you tell us you need that coverage, we're going to pay it, though. It still has to be medically necessary. And that, again, that's protection for the companies and for all of us as premium payers, so people aren't overusing the system or receiving treatment for things that they shouldn't be receiving, or you know, asking for prescription drugs they don't need, those kinds of things. So just because a benefit is there does not mean that a carrier has to pay for it if it's not medically necessary, or if the protocol hasn't been followed according to what they think is appropriate in treating that particular condition or disease. And that's often where consumers get confused, or I always liken it to hail. When we get hail in North Dakota, and the neighbor on one side of the block gets their entire roof paid for, and the neighbor across the street only gets half their roof paid for, they come to us and say, that's not fair. Well, did you look at your policy? Are your policies the same? Is your company the same? Did you get the same type of hail damage? I mean, companies are going to look at things differently. Policies are going to be different. You could have different visit limits under your policy for diabetes nutritional counseling than Representative Casper does. You wouldn't get this, you know, just because the benefit is there doesn't mean you get the same exact coverage.
Further questions for Rebecca? That's it?
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. You may not be done. Stay close. All right. Committee discussion at this point? You want to wait? Okay. Committee members, we're going to take about a 10-minute break at 22, according to that clock. We will come back in and set up our panelists. If they'll come up to the center part, we'll reserve that for those folks, and we'll start in just a few minutes. Members, we have with us today from Blue Cross Blue Shield, Jessica Simpson, from Medica, Kate Johansson, and from Sanford Health Plan, Lisa, who has been a regular forever with us in the interim. And we're going to start, although the schedule looks different than the way we're going to run it, we're going to start with Lisa. And again, keep in mind that what they were asked to do was basically impossible. But having recognized that, we still expect them to do it. All right, Lisa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I will start off by trying to elaborate on what Rebecca Turnus had previously discussed, which is what you have in front of you is the 2014 state. And what I would like to do is talk about what the current state is, because in reality, Sanford Health Plan other carriers have had to augment this 2014 state with mental health parity. CSIO, which is the Center for Information and Insurance Oversight, which is a new regulatory body that governs the marketplace, has issued multiple FAQs and bulletins clarifying habilitative care, clarifying hearing aids, also addressing some of the mental health issues as well. So we have, the chart you're looking at already doesn't reflect what we filed for 2015 and 2016 benefits. And in fact, the benefits have done nothing but gotten richer, again, because of those additional bulletins issued by the government. So I just want to walk you through the differences. The summary is that the current benchmark plan, Sanford Health Plan, and once I talk you through the changes we've already made, which are not reflected on this chart, and the difference between the default plan for the 2017 year of Blue Cross Blue Shield is minimal. In my opinion, from a health plan standpoint, it does not matter policy-wise which plan you choose. It has so minimal impact at this point in time, because the government has already set the benchmark, and we've already gone there. And so, and we all have to follow the subsequent bulletins that the government has issued on hearing aids and habilitative care and mental health parity, so that we've already closed many of those gaps. And so while we can talk a lot today about which plan to select, in my opinion, there's so few decision points at this time that will have any sort of significant impact on the members' benefits. So if I may just walk through, thank you, you had already pointed, Mr. Chairman, out private duty nursing. When you go to organ transplants and transportation to recipient, Sanford Health Plan provides a dollar allowance, basically. I think it's anywhere from $8,000, if I remember correctly. So it applies towards food, lodging, there's per diems set for the day as well. So that is a dollar allowance that is provided. If you talk to an actuary, if any one of them were here today, they would say it's actuarially insignificant. Birthing centers, sorry, there's no page numbers on here. Yes.
When you give those, is that a lifetime annual, that $8,000?
Per transplant.
Per transplant, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So in episode of care, transplants are typically compensated for through an episode of care. You're paying for the pre, post transplant services, which includes the travel component of it. When you scroll to the next difference, which is birthing centers, Sanford Health Plan does not oppose covering birthing centers. However, in the states that we operate in, with the exception of Minnesota, where it's mandated actually, there has to be some further clarification about credentialing, scope, licensure issues, so that once those items would be addressed, that there is no concerns, we would cover birthing centers as long as there's proper oversight by and licensed providers and facility licensure and oversight as well. So again, not significant. And off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you how many birthing centers there are in North Dakota, if there's any yet at this point. Next if you move down to category five on mental health, group therapy listed as non-covered per Sanford Health Plan, that was not covered in 2014, it is covered today, and we cannot roll that back, I guess is the term someone used, because that is a mental health parity. So we actually all had to step through a mental health parity test. There's actually a test that we have to walk through with our actuaries to ensure parity, and group therapy falls within that test. So that is now a covered benefit and will not be rolled back regardless of what benchmark plan you choose. Same thing with detox services. That was a mental health parity item as well. It is covered inpatient, outpatient. It's often covered as part of a partial hospitalization stay. It is not covered when the sole purpose is confinement, just and that is it, and there's no other medical component to it, but it is a covered benefit. Habilitative services are covered as well, obviously, and in 2017, Ms. Turn has already pointed out that we will have to revise our limits so that they cannot be combined anymore, and that is a federal law, so we don't have a choice on that either, so we will all, again, kind of default to the original. And the next item would be the speech therapy to correct speech impediments when there's no other medical issues going on is a true differentiating factor. Hearing aids for individuals, I believe all health plans cover cochlear implants, so I just want to clarify there is a difference between cochlear implants and hearing aids. And we also do now cover hearing aids due to some clarifying bulletins from the government, so that is something that has also gone away from it's not covered, now it is covered. So regardless of the fact that you think that if you set this plan it won't be covered, that is not a true fact. It is covered now.
That's for both age groups?
That is for both age groups. If there's a medical issue, hearing aids are not covered for natural progression of hearing loss due to age. And those are your, what's left over, and Medicare does cover you, so I just want to preface that and set the bar a little bit. Mr. Chairman, concludes the major differences, and in my opinion, there is such a small difference anymore between a Blue Cross Blue Shield plan and a Sanford Health Plan that it would cause me and my health plan no consternation, regardless which one you choose.
Questions? So Representative Casper?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify on the rehab, speech therapy to correct speech impediments, Sanford does not cover that, or do you?
We do cover speech therapy services when it's performed by a certified speech therapist. There are some coding nuances, and sometimes there's some vague coding with it. The sole purpose is, I have a list that may not be covered, but if they're typically children have other medical conditions that are going on with their speech therapy, so it's a more all-encompassing, and you're actually treating a condition. And so sometimes it may be covered as part of a separate condition. If the only issue that they have is lisps or maybe stuttering, which many children grow out of, it may not be covered just solely for that purpose.
Further questions for Lisa? Senator Mather?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Lisa. I would like to get a clarification of the statement about rollback. Earlier when we were talking with the insurance commissioner's office, I got the impression that the plans that we would be choosing from, the 10 plans, are actually old plans compared to what is in place come next year. But you were saying that these requirements, these federal government requirement changes, really do not permit us to go to sort of rolling back, even though the plans here don't have that coverage. So is there any service in these two lists, Blue Cross Blue Shield and Sanford list?
Mr. Chairman, and
going back if we chose one of those?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mather, the only item that I could think that if you were to choose a Blue Cross Blue Shield plan that carriers might consider rolling back is the private duty nursing, which again is such a used in very specific cases and not has, does not have an actuarial impact. The other item would be the organ transplant benefit, would be something that you might see carriers default to the lowest common denominator. That could be, those are decisions that are made by a different body within my organization, so they would decide whether or not they want to keep it as a value add to our members as a service, and if it's within our mission of our health plan. But the past, that, in my opinion, that's the only thing that's left that is not fall within the hearing aids, the mental health parity, the habilitative role.
Thank you.
Further questions for Lisa? All right, let's go to Medica next.
All right, well, first of all...
Would you turn your mic on? You just press that button. Thank you, and pull it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Kaiser. First of all, I haven't met all of you yet. I'm replacing Jay McLaren, if you've worked with him. Again, my name is Kate Johansson, and I'm representing Medica, and I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you this morning. I think that looking at this plan, really there are a few kind of threshold differences. Medica, I think, has perhaps a few more benefits than the other two plans. That's primarily a result of the fact that they've been built for other states where those are mandated benefits. The only areas of discrepancy that we would point out would be the infertility benefit versus your current EHB benchmark, that I'm certain we'll get into with questions, and then the private duty nursing issue, which was just addressed very well by Lisa. Second, I just wanted to clarify that Medica does include dental. It doesn't show up on this chart because while other carriers do embed dental, we partner with Delta, so we do cover that service. Beyond that, I think that Lisa has really summed up well the decision before you, which is that there are no material differences before you with respect to these three small group plans, and we would be comfortable with any of them as an EHB benchmark. So I'll keep my comments short and let questions dictate the conversation from there, or let Blue Cross speak as well.
Questions? Representative Fair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hansen, my question is, if we chose Medica, which is in the third column, would we expect premiums to go up, go down, stay the same? What do we expect?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fair, I think premiums would not be impacted by selection of Medica as the EHB. Rather, they would be subject to all the same forces that control premium rates and the process of review by your state insurance commissioner.
Representative Franz Fogg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lisa, you used the term value added when you were talking. Does that imply that there may not be a fixed cost for some service?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there is a fixed cost and it's built into the premium. The question that would be posed amongst our product development group and our actuary would be, if we were to take out a transportation benefit for organ transplant recipients, how much would that reduce, how many points would that bring down our filed premiums? And if the answer is it's minimal, and it's just going to upset our members and or the providers with whom we have transportation or organ transplant contracts with, then sometimes the answer is it's not worth it. And that is a reality of the business decisions that we do make on a regular basis. So I hope that answers your question.
Further questions for Kate? Kate, just looking at your chart, mm-hmm. On page one, Medica does cover acupressure, acupuncture, biofeedback, and I don't see that as being covered by the others, and those are perhaps not big items, but they're certainly different. And then on detox, for some reason there's an asterisk on your X. What does that mean?
Of course, Chair Kaiser, those are excellent questions. First, yes, Medica does cover the three categories that you mentioned on the first page of acupuncture, acupressure, and biofeedback. We limit that coverage to 15 visits annually and require that they are provided by a doctor. So again, there's not significant actuarial impact there because it's such a limited service. Not many people actually wind up using that service, so there would not be a significant rate increase. That also being said, with respect to detox, that asterisk is there to imply that really we only provide detox when it is medically necessary. Of course, the previous speaker addressed that all services should be provided when they're medically necessary. That asterisk is there for other states. just to implicate, for example, if someone was picked up in public, they were intoxicated, brought to the county jail, and then they just really needed to sober up, we would not consider that medically necessary. As opposed to, say, someone was intoxicated, needed to have a surgery, we would need to detox them before putting them into surgery. That would be medically necessary, and that would be covered.
Okay. Any further questions for Kate? Thank you very much. All right. For Blue Cross Blue Shield, Jessica.
I actually provided...
If you could pull it just a little bit closer, please. Thank you.
Sure. I actually provided, have a testimony here, too. And so if I could, I'll go through some of the talking points in my testimony, and then I will address some of the benefits in the grid provided by Deputy Commissioner Ternus. Good morning, Chairman Kaiser and members of the Healthcare Reform Committee. My name is Jessica Stimson, and I'll kindly correct Chairman Kaiser. I get the Jessica Simpson quite a bit, but it is Stimson. There is a T. And I'm the Healthcare Reform Advisor at Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Dakota. When we initially started analyzing impacts to the 2017 benchmark selection process, there were just a couple of key points at Blue Cross Blue Shield North Dakota that we wanted to bring up. In the initial meeting, I think held a couple weeks ago, I know that there was discussion of infertility and looking at those PERS benchmark plans as well. So I'll maybe shift a little bit from the small group plans into those PERS-based products, but beginning in 2016, you may be aware that groups from 50 to 100 will be transitioning into metallic plans, as they'll now be under the Affordable Care Act's definition of a small group. So if the PERS plan were to be selected, I think, or if we were to remain, I'm sorry, if we were to remain in our non-grandfathered metallic plans that we administer today, that will be a result in the loss of certain benefits for our existing groups that are now purchasing coverage in that large group market that will become small group and move to these metallic plans. And infertility services would be an example of the services no longer covered, and really probably the most glaring change between the existing metallic plan and the PERS plans. So a change to a benchmark plan that would be more similar to the benefits that they carry today would obviously reduce some of the market disruption that we would see for those small groups that will be transitioning. On the other side, a change to a benchmark plan such as North Dakota PERS would have a rate impact to the metallic plans that we sell today. Our initial estimate for modifying our existing metallic plans to include services such as infertility suggests about a 1% premium increase. I'd also like to note a secondary impact. I realize that Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Dakota is the only plan in the state that offers infertility services as a standard benefit on most of our products, the exception being our metallic products. So we do have a secondary impact to our grandfathered individual group plans as well as our non-grandfathered plans. Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Dakota currently administers the infertility benefit with lifetime dollar limits. Under the Affordable Care Act, annual and lifetime dollar limits are prohibited. So these are because this prohibition on annual and lifetime dollar limits does not just impact services under the benchmark plan, it actually impacts essential health benefits that could be that are covered on any one of our health plans, and that includes grandfathered health plans as well as any of our non-grandfathered large group plans. So these policy segments would need to be modified as well, so it becomes a pretty large scale change for us to have to go back through and review the current infertility benefit to determine what type of new policies would have to be put in place to manage the services and the costs under fertility. So there may be a small impact to premiums as a result of those changes as well. And then finally, as with any substantial changes to existing health plans, a modification of the benchmark does require a significant time and investment of our administrative resources. And I think the same could be said for Sanford and Medica as well when we make those changes. So that concludes my written testimony. I guess I would like to address a couple of items on the grid as well, unless there are any questions before I proceed.
Any questions for Jessica? Senator Mervin?
Thank you, Ms. Stimson. What group do you refer to when you talk about North Dakota PERS? In our charts, we have three.
And I guess I would say I refer to all of them.
Okay.
Because they all cover the infertility service that I was discussing.
Okay.
And I'm actually going to discuss a little bit about the three PERS plans for you.
Thank you.
This was data that we actually provided to the Department of Insurance because we were administering the plan in March of 2014. So this was data that we've had a chance to review. So I think I'll start there as a result of your question. When I look at the North Dakota PERS PPO, we've got the grandfather plan, we've got the North Dakota PERS non-grandfather plan, and then we've got a non-grandfathered high deductible health plan. When we created the non-grandfathered plans, we really took the base benefits or the core plan design of the PERS grandfathered health plan when we designed that non-grandfathered plan. And of course, as a result of it being non-grandfathered, we did have to supplement services. So I guess I would go through and indicate, for instance, under prescription drugs, we see contraceptives as being not covered on the grandfathered health plan. However, as a result of the ACA Women's Health Preventive Benefits, this would be something that would have to be supplemented, which is why you see it covered in the non-grandfathered health plans on those PERS products. In addition, that would be the same under preventive for the smoking and tobacco cessation benefit as well. So really, I think what you're seeing, I think the point or the point that I'd like to make is I don't know that the grandfathered health plan really would need to be a consideration as your benchmark EHB plan. You'll get a better feel in those non-grandfathered plans if you're actually looking for what that plan is going to look like in 2017, because it does carry all of the Affordable Care Act requirements for non-grandfathered health plans. We, of course, would have to supplement with the pediatric dental and vision, as well as, adding infertility services that aren't covered under the existing plan right now. So specifically with the three PERS plans, I guess I would maybe steer away from looking at the North Dakota PERS grandfathered health plan, because the non-grandfathered health plan gives you a more comprehensive look. So then if you compare the non-grandfathered health plan to the existing small group health plans between Blue Cross, Stanford, and Medica that you see, I think the key differences really are the private duty nursing and the infertility services. Lisa already mentioned that, really the impact of private duty nursing is a very minimal actuarial impact. Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Dakota would agree with that. And then, of course, the infertility services, which would have, as we suggest or anticipate, about a 1% premium impact if added into the benchmark plan for 2017.
Any questions for Jessica? Jessica, would you just cover private duty nursing on your column? You do not cover it, or is that now?
Societal
requires it, or will require it?
No, Societal doesn't require private duty nursing, and I haven't seen anything that would suggest that they will be covering private duty nursing. Private duty nursing is not a covered service on the benchmark plan chosen in, was it 2012 now? So it was a service that we chose not to cover as well. We stayed very conservative when creating that 2014 plan to really try and stay on par exactly with the benchmark plan as it was submitted to avoid any adverse selection. We weren't sure at that time what type of selection we would see, so we wanted to stay right on par.
And then on organ transplants, are there any differences, or have those been changed? You do not cover transportation and lodging.
Sure. Chairman Kaiser, thank you for the question. You know what, this is actually something I would like to go back on, because I think transportation for the recipient in an emergency situation, if it was medically necessary, I believe that would be a covered service. However, stipends or reimbursement of mileage and things of that nature are typically not covered. So I can go back and get a more definitive answer for you on that.
Any further questions? Rehabilitative therapies? Did you cover that? I'm sorry.
I can certainly touch on the therapies as well. If we go to under the mental health and substance abuse, you'll see it touches on habilitative and rehabilitative under autism services, and you'll see North Dakota, Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Dakota on the small group plan has not covered. Rehabilitative therapy isn't a necessary treatment, I guess, for autistic services. However, if there is a child with autism who had an injury, we of course would cover rehabilitative therapy in those types of situations. So I kind of want to break it down, I guess, in a couple of different categories, because autism services, there may be reasons for habilitative therapy. If there are speech delays or other things as a result of their autism, that would be covered. But rehabilitative therapy is a covered service, just not under autism.
Senator Mazzie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and any of the panelists. You know, I see all of these benefits sort of becoming quite similar, these benefit packages. And I presume at some point it's sort of doesn't really create a market advantage anymore for companies competing against each other.
There is a fee for that in this committee as well as regular committees.
But I'm wondering, is there a scale advantage in terms of plans becoming more similar? Is the healthcare industry benefit anyway by things becoming more consistent amongst insurers? I mean, I find a lot of these hospitals and clinics, I mean, there's just a ton of people working, just figuring out who pays what and when. I mean, it's getting to the point where we have more staff behind the scenes than actually delivering care. Is there a benefit to these plans becoming more similar in terms of overall healthcare costs, or is that not the case? Anybody care to comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'd love to engage in a theoretical conversation about that over a beer sometime. Short answer, there is value to standardization, I believe, in the health insurance industry, and that was the overarching intent when Congress passed the law and established the philosophy of having a benchmark plan. We see this in the Medicare supplement market, where the government and the NAC has basically established plans A through L. At that point, and there is standardization, and what we've seen in the Medicare supplement market is it becomes a commodity. And when everything is driven on price, and the carriers then are left to compete on service and quality, because price becomes very close and comes down to sometimes pennies and dollar differences. From the federal government standpoint, standardization does bring them value in the sense of economies of scale. There are some drawbacks as well, though. From an employer standpoint, specifically in a small group, with the transition to bronze, gold, silver plans, and in the individual market, it limited the types of plans that they can now purchase, which becomes more of a concept of, I used to have this, or I used to be able to, as an employer, set my deductible and out-of-pocket maximum and co-pays to be this, that, and that. And now I'm told to select it from a more limited menu, which does not allow me to have as much control over my costs. And so those would be the drawbacks that we hear from our small employer group market and the individual market as well, since the transition to the bronze, gold, and silver platinum.
Representative Casper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lisa, do you know how many small group plans that Sanford has in North Dakota?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kaiser, off the top of my head, I do not have that number with me today, but I can find that out from our client service team.
Further questions? So, I'd just like all of your reaction, if I understand, at least Jessica, one of the points you were making is that there appears to be very little difference. Medica is offering a few things that the other two are not, but with Societal's rules and regs that have come down, the Sanford and Blue Cross Blue Shield plan are relatively similar. The real enhancement is in the non-grandfathered PERS program, and that adds, as I see it, the infertility treatment and sexual dysfunction drugs. I don't know how much that's utilized, but that is also a category that is not in the others. And was there compared? And it's hard because there are some slight differences between even the Sanford and Blue Cross Blue Shield plan and the Medica plan we've identified. But are there other significant differences between the PERS non-grandfathered plan that I've missed, other than infertility, sexual dysfunction?
I don't think so, from my analysis.
Any further questions? Rebecca, while they're still up here, if you could come up, I just have a question. This decision that we are contemplating or deliberating on, I guess we're not necessarily going to make, we are going to make a decision, I guess. But it is binding, is that correct? I mean, this is for beginning in 2017 for all policies, and for how long is it binding? I guess the question is, if we don't put infertility treatment in and we add it later on, then it becomes a state mandate that we pay for. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We're told today that this is for plan years starting 2017. We have not been told for how long that will be in place. As I said earlier, the first decision where we were told it was for plan years 14 and 15, and now we're looking at 16. So at this point, that's all we know.
Okay. Representative Casper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rebecca, do you know how many small group plans that Sanford does have in North Dakota? You have the Blue Cross number. Do you have the Sanford number and the Medica number?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Casper, I don't think I have any of those numbers unless one of my staff has the number of plans by all the companies offered.
Yeah.
No.
All right. Thank you, Rebecca. Any other questions for any member of our panel? All right. Oh, Lisa?
I just have one additional comment regarding the infertility benefit. While Blue Cross has the most experience in administering that benefit and has testified to an actuarial value, one of the considerations is there's an actual value to the benefit itself, which is how many, what the lifetime maximum is, what the benefit is itself. There is also an actuarial impact to the fact that infertility treatment does result in multiple gestations, so twins, triplets. And with twins and triplets, there is a direct tie to prenatal stays, and those do get very expensive. And so it is important to take the fact that into effect, as well as that over the long run will impact everyone's policies when you see multiple pregnancies.
Important point.
Just to augment what Lisa has already rightly stated, Medica did project out how the infertility treatments would impact our individual market. We have about 50,000 people in North Dakota in our individual market, and anticipated about a $400,000 to $600,000 increase overall for the year in premiums, which would play out to about $8 to $12 per policyholder. That also, of course, is based on information because we have not covered this benefit previously. The direct impact of providing what's on this chart, it does not take into account the secondary complications that often result from infertility treatments, the most concerning of which to us from a price standpoint would be NICU and premature births. So.
Representative Casper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But currently then, we're not faced with the decision of whether or not to cover infertility because it's not covered. can't change how the plans are currently set up. So that really is off the table unless we go to the PERS plan, which covers it. Is that correct?
Well, my understanding is that within the 10 options you have, you're choosing between the PERS plan, which would cover it, and thus require us to cover it in our small group products. So I'm just trying to provide information on the cost impact. If you... Correct.
That is correct. The only, you would have to select a PERS program, I believe, or one of the programs that does cover it.
Right.
Any further questions? Well, thank you, you guys. Thank you again. You did great under the circumstances. I think you provided what we needed. All right. At this point, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to make a comment on our deliberations? Anyone? All right, seeing none, committee, we are at the point of committee discussion on this issue. Discussion or suggestions or direction or... Senator Mather?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I find that there's kind of like two paths going here. One is the decisions we make, but also the decisions that regulators in the federal government is making. And it seems like those decisions that the federal government is making is essentially driving all the plans to being pretty much equal. And at some point, I would suspect it makes sense for the insurance companies to get together and have one organization that figures out utilization review or something, because the coverage is supposed to be the same. But in light of that, initially I was a little bit concerned that we were sort of, maybe not as responsible as we could have been in terms of having an earlier meeting to decide this. But I see now that the consequence is quite minimal of the decision. And so I see it in a different light. And when we made this decision a few years ago, it was, I believe, quite impactful. And I actually believe we made the incorrect decision, that we should have went to the other plan. But it was much more impactful than now. And so that's kind of my observation about what's going on and where we're at on this.
Representative Casper. So that I understand your motion, you are moving that we select the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan as our essential health benefit plan. We have a motion by Representative Casper, seconded by Representative Francois. Further discussion. Senator Mather.
Mr. Chairman, one of the concerns I have there is the private duty nursing. And I'm just wondering if anybody on the committee has received any feedback about that, or is that actually becoming more similar than the chart indicates?
We could ask for a comment. I don't want to speak for them, but it was my understanding, based on that, even Blue Cross Blue Shield will cover it if it's medically necessary. And I think if you dig into the weeds, all other carriers are going to want it to be medically necessary before they cover it. But that was one of the distinguishing factors on our chart, which isn't accurate, so, yes.
Thank you, Representative Kaiser. You were just speaking about the private duty nursing, and private duty nursing is an exclusion on the policy. So if there are medical necessity requirements, it is not a covered service. The medical necessity piece I was talking about was in reference to transportation services for transplants. So just to be clear, if you were to select the Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Dakota benchmark, private duty nursing would continue to be a not covered service under a benchmark plan for 2017.
Okay.
Could I ask a follow-up? Could you describe what private duty nursing is, please?
You know, Senator Maiden, I unfortunately am not the person to describe private duty nursing. I know pretty many more know that it is a level of care at home that typically is provided by a registered nurse. And where it falls on the level of care between your home health services and other inpatient, true inpatient services, I'm not certain, but we can certainly look for additional information or can work through Megan to follow up.
Do you have an actuarial value of that service?
What I receive from our actuarial area is that the value of that service is minimal. So,
the premium increase is minimal.
If any at all.
Okay. Further discussion?
Well, I would, in further discussion, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Representative Casper, why wouldn't we want to, or why wouldn't you want to include that? It seems to me that it is the type of service that is cheaper in the long run than someone getting nursing care in a nursing home, where much of this is happening now, where there are discharges earlier from the hospital, and the discharges don't reflect that the person is completely well, but that the person needs nursing care not as acute as in a hospital. So that would mean going to a nursing home or having a private duty nurse. And it would seem like it would be an important benefit to have. And if it has no, you know, actuarial value that clarifies that it would be a premium increase, probably even a decrease in some cases, it would seem like we should include that. And that's really the only difference here between these plans as I see them.
Unless anyone is in the audience that wants to respond to that, there is in-home health care, and that does provide nursing services on a part-time basis. Private duty nursing is literally 8 hours a day in nursing care that's there and available, and in those cases, if it's medically necessary, you would think it would be in a transitional care facility or a nursing home, that it would not be. To put it in a home, in all honesty, there could be some extenuating times when it would be medically necessary and unavailable. But I personally struggled to know when that would be, that you wouldn't be in a transitional health care facility or a nursing home, which would be less expensive than this option. This is a very, very expensive option. To have a nurse in your home 24 hours a day is really expensive compared to a nursing home or a transitional health care facility. And so there may be a time, but even though these other groups check it, it's going to be very limited in its availability, if at all.
I guess I was thinking that it wouldn't necessarily be that robust. It wouldn't necessarily be a nurse 24/7. It might be a nurse a few hours a day.
That's in
Versus.
That's in home health care.
Yeah.
That is available.
Under these plans?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Representative Fair?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And regarding the motion, I was wrestling between the Sanford and Blue Cross plans, and as I'm understanding, they're currently fitting in line with the Sanford plan. I understand they're substantially the same. I'm understanding that they're saying there would not be premium differences. There's very little tweaks, difference between them. It seems almost inconsequential. But from my standpoint, if we're basically going with the Sanford plan now, unless there's a reason to change, I would think that we would stay with the Sanford plan unless there's a reason to change to something else, some advantage either in terms of premium difference, which I understand there isn't, very little difference in terms of coverage. And so I don't see the advantage of switching to the Blue Cross plan from what we're currently doing.
Further discussion. It is the largest small group plan, so any change would affect the largest number of small groups in a single plan. So whatever differences there are, it would affect them, is the only rationale that I could see. Senator Manning?
I have one further question. I'm still waiting for Representative Casper's answer to my question. But who decides what the actual plan detail is? So we make this decision. For example, in just the last legislative session, special session, deciding on the carrier for PERS, there's all kinds of follow-up stuff about, well, they defined this this way, they defined this that way, and I imagine that will continue. So I'm wondering, in this case, who is the final arbitrator as to what one plan is as it is rolled out and agreed to by the federal government? Who is that arbitrator?
And this is an oversimplification, but when we design essential health benefit plans, every carrier in our state must meet those standards. Every carrier then can offer whatever additional options they want in any plan. However, what experience has shown us, and we were, and I think collectively, we were somewhat naive initially in selecting an essential health benefit plan. And as I mentioned at the very outset, it didn't matter where the state went. If they went in the middle, or if they went on the bottom, or they went on the top, it didn't matter. That's where everybody migrated to. So deciding your essential health benefits simply sets not the ceiling and not the floor. It sets really both of them because of adverse selection. You start offering anything of significance above and beyond that, the only potential customers you have are people who need that. And they will self-select themselves in and drive that plan through the ceiling because it's violating the principle of insurance of spreading risk. It's concentrating risk. So the carriers, they have full option. And I agree with Senator Mathern. The big decision that we made was made when we first selected essential health benefits. And I'm not advocating against the motion or anything else. This is your one chance as state legislators to make a minor change, if you want to. And the real only change we have, although there are minor changes between those plans, the big change is if you go to the PERS program, you're going to add some new benefits that 2 years ago were available in 9 plans and not available in 1. And now they're not available in all plans, except for the PERS program. It's just been reversed. But this is your one shot to make a change, and but we had a shot before. So we can't make the big decision that we could have made 2 years ago, but this is your window. Further discussion? Representative Casper. Take the roll for the adoption of the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan in column one, whatever that is labeled as.
Right, Mr. Chairman, this is a matter of clarification. Essentially what the motion, how it will be reflected,
modified,
would be that this committee make a recommendation to the legislative management that we select an essential health benefit benchmark plan based upon the Blue Cross Blue Shield small group plan.
That's correct.
Okay. Representatives Becker, Fair?
Yes.
Frenzbach? Glassheim, Johnson?
Yes.
LaFleur?
Yes.
Loyson?
Yes.
Mitzcock?
Yes.
Rohr, Casper?
Yes.
Senators Campbell, Mathern?
No.
O'Connell? And Representative Kaiser?
Yes.
That motion does pass.
All right. We will be forwarding that relatively immediately forward. Before we disband, we are going to get out of here by noon. I do have some handouts for committee members, especially for our new ones, but it was beneficial, very beneficial for me. It's a presentation I saw last week on just the background of essential health benefits, how we got to where we are, and the type is kind of small, but I think you'll find it, especially if you haven't been on this committee before, you'll find it very beneficial to review. I also had the opportunity to see a presentation on the 1332 waiver, which is going to be our next area that we'll tackle. That's going to take a lot more time, but I ask you to review this and to, it will provide some background, very valuable background to you on 1332. It's a little bit, 1332 is a little bit similar to what we just did with essential health benefits. There isn't as much flexibility as you may wish they have, but I will share with you my perspective. Sometimes it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission. And I'm at a point where I think we take a very aggressive posture on 1332. And in some cases, even if they're saying it may not be allowed, that we ask, we develop the concept, develop a state plan, and then go to them and ask for a waiver if necessary or something else. But I just encourage the committee not to limit yourself and simply let them dictate every part of the 1332 innovation waivers. The term innovation means innovation. And so I think we should take some liberty with it. But I do ask you prior to our next meeting to review it, because it will give you a background, and we'll get folks in to help us understand it, certainly. And we've got the great people here in our state that can help us truly understand it. But any other comments? Senator O'Connell. Jen and I did talk about that, and was it next week? No, I think it might be in September. Is that about right? Yep. If that's right, we will get the notification out to folks and give you some alternative dates, and appreciate the task you undertook today. This is the first time I've ever seen an interim committee on the first meeting have to make decisions like we made today. Senator Mattern, I hope you appreciate what he said. This is an important decision we made today. It may not be as important as the previous one, but this has a bearing for the future. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Mattern.
Yeah, I was going to comment on your earlier comment that we'd be open to some innovation. I thought, for example, one of the things that I was actually interested in is addressing that infertility issue. You know, where we've gone from, you know, kind of pretty broad coverage to a lot of insurers to only one group. There really is some ground in there that we should really be working on to help some of these folks. Mm-hmm. And but that would then have to come under, you know, some sort of innovation, because there's all kinds of rules about that.
Right.
You know, lifetime coverages and all that. But I just second your comments about, I hope we can be more innovative as we go through that next part. Thank you.
And committee members, again, I just want to point out the timelines here. This, we are talking about, I believe, although Rebecca has never, is it January 1, 2017, that innovation grant, when do they have to be submitted?
Chairman Kaiser, we have absolutely
No idea
on the 1332 innovation waivers. There was that initial guidance, which didn't say much, other than you pretty much have to meet all of the ACA requirements to do your own thing, which is not doing your own thing. So,
but keep in mind that if it is 2017, it's likely to be January 1, 2017, which is before we go into session again, you'll recall. So, in response, Senator O'Connell, to your question, we're going to be meeting fast and furious at the outset to get to wherever we are going to get, because if we decide to do anything, if there's a lengthy process, legislation has to be written to accommodate the changes. and passed, but you have to actually, I believe, if I recall, submit the legislation with your request for the waiver.
Mr. Chairman, for the, at least the exchanges, way back when, you had to either submit the legislation or prove it was pretty close to being done. And I should add, I will check with CSIO if they expect any further guidance on the 1332. I don't know if you heard of anything last week, but I will we'll go direct to them and ask if they expect any future guidance soon, because as you said, they were to start January 1st, 2017, so it's already late for states.
And just from background, and we can just have a discussion about this, CSIO, HHS, at the very outset, had a lot of insurance types of folks. They had a lot of regulators, previous insurance commissioners that they brought in as for technical and managerial expertise. They have one person left who has an insurance background, and it is creating lots of problems in terms of trying to, well, first of all, we've lost all our connections. I mean, we used to have some folks in there that we knew personally. There was a woman there, Teresa Miller, who was phenomenal. I could call her or email her, and she would get back to me within 2 to 3 hours. And couldn't answer many questions, but could at least give us some help. We don't have anything right now.
Mr. Chairman, Cecile just lost their director again, so we're starting over again.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know where this fits in our committee maybe, but doctors and healthcare providers are kind of irate about the coding system now. They're using number 9 now, and they're going to have to go to the 10, and like Senator Mathis says, there's going to be more people behind the scenes doing the work, and I don't know if that fits in our committee. Really, I think you said I'd bring it up, but the coding that they have to go through, the especially the doctors, is going to cause a big problem, they say.
Okay. We'll take that under advisement and see if we can find a way to consider it. Any other comments or discussion from committee members? All right. We'll entertain a motion to adjourn. Senator Call moves. Is there a second? Seconded by Representative Fair. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. You're outvoted. We are adjourned.